We have about 20 minutes for Q&A. I'll pass the microphone around, and please state your name and organization. And we'll kind of alternate between the in-person and the online audience.
That's a great picture.
I think there'll be a lot of questions, so we'll try and get through as many as we can, and then there'll be a bit of time to gather later as well.
Thank you for those presentations. Those were wonderful. I'm Laura Schreich, and I'm with USAID and Bureau for Food Security. Michael, you spoke a lot about fertilizer, but always with also my understanding was with improved seed varieties. Tom, your main message at the end was that the fertilizer subsidies need to also include other complementary investments, but you never mentioned improved seed varieties. Was that implicit in what you were saying? And if so, I think it needs to be really okay. Needs to come out. And if it wasn't implicit, then why? The difference in what you guys are talking about. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. So yes, public R&D is, you know, improved seed varieties are one of the key things that come out of public R&D systems. So I'll be happy to say it explicitly. I agree that improved seed varieties that are more fertilizer responsive is definitely a key priority.
We'll take it back to our online audience and then come back here.
Sure. This first question comes with a bit of context. We have Leslie Gardner who says, the voice of smallholders seems to be missing too often in these discussions, and due to their remote locations, poor roads, and need for seasonal credit, a growing number of middlemen offer agrochemicals on credit in exchange for the right to purchase harvest at very low prices. And these middlemen are not manufacturers, but they're distributors whose power comes from access to transport, finance, and markets. And there's an alarming change in power relations and problems with distribution channels that will affect the sustainability in the long term. So Sierra Bercio says, how do we avoid the danger of benefits being captured by the manufacturers and traders and not the smallholder farmer themselves?
I mean, that's a very interesting observation, and I think it's a contentious issue. I mean, when you get into a kind of a sole source supplier of anything, there's a concern that someone's going to grab up most of the, you know, I used the term of money being left on the table in terms of productivity increases that weren't taking place. And I think we would all agree that if it's a highly monopolistic kind of situation, there's at least that possibility that a lion's share of that will be. And so again, I don't know that I have anything in general to say about that. I mean, I think we, you know, there are some instances where we see well-developed value chains that will actually lend inputs against a standing crop, and there's often, you know, there tends to be a little bit more, I think, of an equitable distribution just because there are more shared interests. If there's simply a middleman, there's certainly that kind of possibility. Again, what we see in the Mozambique study, I think, is interesting. Again, I want to emphasize that was built around an effort to create a more competitive supply sector, and I think our per capita expenditure, our living standards results suggest that while surely other people were making money off the fertilizer sale, there seemed to have been plenty left over to improve the standard of living of the family. So, you know, I would agree that we need to be mindful of what are those market structures out there that might permit the finance of these kinds of things, and competition in those circuits are certainly very, very important.
I'd add to that. I think in the question, even though I didn't hear the person who asked that question, were they referring to in subsidy programs, or were they referring to just normal, you know, commercial supply channels? That's a big problem in subsidy programs and in subsidy supply chains. It's quite common that actors are trying to grab a little bit of the benefits of that before they actually get out to farmers. I don't see that happening a great deal in competitive commercial systems.
Again, I want to thank everybody here had come and were quite justified, and so hearing two of the best agricultural experts in the world talk about one of the most high priority issues. But I had a question that really is mostly directed to Professor Jane. Your prescription is both very complex and requires a considerable amount of public sector capacity. And I think in many countries, the policy people who'd hear you would say that it's too complex, and our public sector is simply incapable of delivering things like that. Mm-hmm. The statistic that I always like is more than 80% of Nigerians don't know where a post office is. The post office has more or less ceased to exist for most Nigerians.
Wow.
The question is, how would you answer that? And is part of the answer the kind of experiments people have done about trying to create private sector or mobile phone resident systems, or anyway, something mm-hmm. that does a end run mm-hmm. Around the public sector.
Yeah, interesting. Wow. Well, first of all, thank you for your kind words at first. Your check will be in the mail later today. Now, about how to do that. There are a couple of schemes that are being set up in Nigeria now to evaluate the mobile, the voucher system through the mobile phone. So I think the jury is out right now, but it'll be very interesting in about a year or two from now to see how that program performs. So I think we'll need to wait a little bit longer to find out. I agree with you that many politicians are looking for fairly simple fixes, and that's what the real seductive appeal of input subsidy programs are. In one fell swoop, you know, you can ensure that farmers are going to be using more fertilizer than they were before. So that's why these programs have such staying power. I think that's our job, your job, all of our jobs, is to try to make the case for why a holistic strategy, even though it's going to be more complex and require, more attention to more different things, why that's still, there's no substitute for getting that in place. Yeah. I can't imagine how, you don't have a public R&D system that's functioning, how you're going to get sustained agricultural productivity growth without it. And I do mean improved seeds, when I say that. That's sort of the group that tends to be producing those seeds.
If I could just say a little bit on those issues as well, and I want to mention a couple of ongoing research efforts. So part of what a good public sector can do is provide, as Tom gave us some examples of zinc deficiencies. Mm-hmm. So one of the questions that is an interesting one is how much higher are those fertilizer response rates if small farmers actually get sort of tailored fertilizer blends that would actually work mm-hmm. for them. That doesn't take care of this, mm-hmm. the soil organic component itself, mm-hmm. but may mean a difference. So mm-hmm. the research group I run, BASIS, has a large project in Western Kenya right now, where we did soil samples in all our farmers' fields, and we came up with four distinct fertilizer blends, most of which included a lot of zinc and boron compared to what's normally available in the market. And now we're actually going to be able to look at that. Does that actually make a big difference? So we'll have those. We actually just finished the survey to find out, but we haven't analyzed the data yet. Mm-hmm. Related to that, there's another BASIS program run by someone named Cheryl Palm at Columbia University, where she's using new mobile soil lab. Basically, it's sort of a soil test in a box sort of thing. It works through the internet, through mobile phones actually, and you get an instantaneous readout of what the fertilizer blend should be. So again, those are interesting. I mean, that's sort of cheapening what the public sector used to provide. I think in reality, and certainly one of the discussions we've had a lot with Cheryl and her team is, okay, great, a farmer knows he needs this much zinc in his blend, but how's a 2-hectare maize farmer, to pick even someone on the larger end, how are they going to buy that? So there's still an issue of the fixed costs of doing that and sharing that information, and secondly, sort of making it actionable. But I think there are some possibilities. One can start to imagine, here's where maybe I've not always been a big fan of the, in development business, we have love with ICT kinds of strategies. But here may be a way you get quick information. Maybe you can find a way to collate orders and low-cost transmission, and if you can get it delivered. There may be ways to do that. So I think there are some new frontiers. And again, that's something that we're sort of pushing out on to see what more can be done mm-hmm. that's better.
We'll go back to our online audience, and then I'll come over here.
Sure. This next question comes from Brent Simpson, and it's for Michael Carter. What guidance does research give us regarding the level of subsidy required and the length of the subsidy period in order to maximize farmer benefit at a minimum cost?
That's a great question as well. And I think what's that's what you know, we don't know from the study in Mozambique is whether a larger amount of subsidy could have been more effective, or whether 2 years or 3 years would have been better. This was effectively a one-year set of results that we were looking at. So there probably are ways to do it better. I guess my own kind of gut instinct is that that, you know, a short time period is probably okay. Although again, in this the first year of this program, I mean, we basically didn't do data collection and didn't implement most of the things because it was just a total disaster. But it seems to us from this that a relatively short period where people had reasonable outcomes, you know, provoked fairly strong learnings. And as I indicated before, they weren't naive learnings. If anything, they were still somewhat pessimistic and conservative, which is probably a good thing, right? You don't want people to get sort of wild-eyed and crazy and start throwing things on. I do think where did the 30% copayment come from? I have no idea. That's just the way the program was set up, and that's how we evaluated it. But we do see a relatively low take-up rate, and with a lot of people saying they just couldn't get that 30%, or they weren't willing in the end to put that 30% into it. So, you know, maybe at that margin, it might be better. But again, I think the political economy issues here are just tremendous in terms of what does a politician want to do. And I want to suggest that there's an asymmetry in the sort of the political staying power here. I mean, if farmers can really learn something in 1 or 2 years from a once-off subsidy program, they're going to be kind of happy about that, right? But the people that really have a lot of political clout are the people that are in the fertilizer business. Tom's comments on acidification of soils. When we met with our crop soil science people in Nairobi, they actually showed us. They said, "Look, what your farmers mostly need is lime." And they said, "But there's no lime subsidy program because there's not much money in it because lime is relatively cheap. So don't even think about it." You know. So there's a political economy here that's not just political economy of the farmer. I think that's something we could maybe solve with temporary subsidies. But the sort of more global political economy of people that actually have a lot more money than farmers do to throw around politically is at a different level. So the political issue here is not a trivial one, but I think there would be warranted. I believe it would be really interesting if one were impressed by these impacts of the impacts of the Mozambique study, to experiment just a little bit more with amounts of subsidies and see if you could get faster take up and greater amounts of learning with a modest increase in the amount of the subsidy offered to the farmer.
In some cases where acidification is a problem, subsidizing lime could be a very important thing, both for learning and, you know, for, I think, we should think about that in terms of maintaining subsidy programs, but using commodities or inputs that farmers really don't have any experience with, and that the private sector may be unwilling to provide on its own. A very good case could be made for those things.
Yeah. All right. Here, I'll pass it to you. Why don't we take just two questions in a row, if that's all right this time, and then we can answer both.
I talked with Tom before this. I'm Jerry Wogan, USAID, and I talked with Tom a little bit before the session, and we agreed that I was one of the more experienced, otherwise older people around remaining in aid. And one of the things that happens is that you see things over and over again. So when I saw Tom's litany of the problems that people face, it seemed to me that if I had asked that same question in 1979, that litany wouldn't be much different. That is, the two things have changed between 1979 and now, maybe three. So one is that government policies with respect to ag marketing and exchange rates and the way in which they screwed farmers on the price side has changed in general. Second, Tom's point about the fact that there's been huge population growth and therefore the land margin has decreased substantially and the possibility for extensive growth is quickly eroding. And I don't remember what the third was, but I guess this fact that there's a growing growth of an urban class that wants higher quality food products, and there's a growth of that farming to satisfy that demand. But the big problems for smallholder staple food producers remain the same, and in fact are probably worse. And so I think it seems to me that there are two major issues that one has to solve. One that's probably impossible, which is all these political economy questions, because the governments are what the governments are, and the interests are what the interests are, and there are ways of getting around it on the margin, but it's very hard to break it. But the second is something that that Michael sort of dismissed, and I've never really been a big fan of, but the information technology. It seems to me that a lot of these problems, including the problems of taking up fertilizer and so on, are information problems. And I can foresee sometime 10 years from now when information technology will have become so pervasive and so developed that a lot of the government problems will disappear in terms of how you do extension and research and so on. And the problem of getting very specific information to farmers on their fields will be a lot easier than now. And I just wondered what you thought about that.
Yeah, I want to ditto the appreciation for your presentation. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
And so my question and comment is about sort of I find it interesting. So we're mentioning some of the problems with corruption and then farmers having access to the inputs that they might need for an organic fertilizers access. And what would happen if we took all that funding, and I hear you saying that, and we put all that money into the R&D and extension side, and we focused on soil fertility management, and the Brown Revolution was where we put all of our money, then would we have all those, you know, problems, like he needs the nitrogen, he needs the lime, he needs, you know, the corruption. So I'm a proponent for focusing more so on the, you know, soil fertility management side of things. And I don't know that we do all agree that we need inorganic fertilizer if we invest ahead of time in some of the more sustainable land care and soil fertility management issues. But I would be curious about what you would think about that.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Michael. So, Jerry, I agree totally. There's a guy named Mark Andreessen who was the one who started Netscape. He predicts that within the next 10 years, every human being on the planet will have a smartphone, that they'll come down in price so dramatically that people in rural Ethiopia will be having smartphones. And apparently, according to him, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of software developers who are right now working on getting apps for this two-thirds of the world that currently doesn't have a smartphone but will within a very short amount of time, in order to provide services to them that will, you know, this whole range of services that you're talking about in terms of information technology. So I can only say that I totally agree. I think it's not a pipe dream. But who knows exactly how that's going to play out. But I do agree that farmers will probably have much more access to technology than they certainly have now. Now, if I understood your question right, it was that in advocating for other kinds of public programs like extension and R&D, there might be corruption issues there as well, and that, you know, how do we mitigate those things? I don't know the answer to that. I'm sure that that's probably correct. When you said we're not all agreed that increased nitrogen has to go up in organic fertilizer, I guess I am aware of that point of view. I can't see how we're going to really triple and quadruple yields right now in Africa without heavy doses of nitrogen, along with increased soil organic carbon and you know, micronutrients and just healthier soils. I can't see how to get that boost in yields without massive increases in nitrogen. So I think
can that happen with organic management of soil versus?
It probably could, but it'll be much more expensive. I think it would cost a lot more to get that kind of nitrogen nutrient from other sources. It's an interesting question, and there are other people out here who might have more information about that than I do. But I'm, from what I've read, it doesn't look likely. Yeah.
And if I could just say very quickly a little bit to Jerry's question. You know, something we haven't talked about, but I forgot that I brought with me these wonderfully colorful handouts, if anyone here in the room would be interested in them. But one of them is actually a discussion of what private sector does, too, because private sector does input subsidies. So one of the things up here is our project in Western Kenya with a private seed company, and their whole marketing strategy is the first year they give away seeds for free. Right, and what's up here is actually the learning that takes place from that, as well, you know, and kind of comparing it to the learning from a public subsidy. So, it's not such a weird, you know, it's not such a weird idea of a temporary subsidy. They only do it once, right? And in a sense, they think it works. And so, it's an interesting issue. And I don't want to dismiss IT either. But one thing that comes out in the Kenya study, in particular, that I think is very specific to African soils, is, you know, how much can you learn from other people, and how much can you learn from yourself, which has something to do with the density of these kinds of programs. The question a moment ago about levels of subsidy is also like how many people need to get seeded with coupons. And one of the things we found in Kenya where we did all this soil quality measurement is in communities where there's a lot of heterogeneity in soil, and we measured it by the Kenyan exchange capacity, which someone told me is the best measure of the likely productivity impacts of fertilizer. In communities where that's highly heterogeneous, people actually don't learn from each other. They don't know what the CEC is anything better than I do, but they do know that what happens on their neighbors does not have a lot to do what happens with themselves. And that sort of points out, number one, that people actually are learning in an intelligent way, but number two, the ability, however we communicate information, if we are in environments where there's a lot of heterogeneity in underlying soil conditions, it's going to be really hard to make information messages be taken up and kind of stick. So those are all things we have to work at. I think IT solutions can be a big part of that in ways we discussed already a little bit. So
We're getting close to time. Since our online audience won't be able to ask you all questions afterwards, I thought we'd take one final question there, and then there should be a little bit of time to nab the speakers afterwards. So last question from online.
Sure. We had one participant who was concerned about farmers who can't afford to participate in a subsidy program, and they made a comment about a policy reform that makes the adoption of best management practices a prerequisite to joining the subsidy program, and he was wondering if you could speak to that. As in, they would adopt a best management practice in lieu of a cash contribution to the subsidy program.
Okay, great. There are some programs right now that are testing that at CIMMYT. I'm aware of some researchers who are looking at that, and I think it has great promise. So I'll just leave it at that, but we'll let the results speak for themselves when they come out, but I think it has great promise.
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea of sort of a sweat equity match, if you will, instead of a cash match. And that's a good idea. I mean, mm-hmm. See that in a number of kind of programs. I mean, I do think the idea of a contribution is useful because I think it helps people take it more seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lena Heron, who manages the BASIS program that I direct, always tells me, you have to get mission buy-in because if they don't put money in it, they aren't going to pay attention. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe the same kind of thing. Maybe farmers are just like USAID missions, that if they have some of their capital involved, then they pay more attention. And I think that's a really interesting kind of idea. I would say that the part of what's coming out of this Mozambique study, and let me reference a study in Ghana that was done by Dean Carlin and colleagues, where they explicitly ran a horse race between risk reduction versus cash grants. So you basically set up a trial where some people got money, and the other arm is people just got insurance. And the question was, which is going to induce greater adoption of new technologies? And what comes out of that study is actually they seem to get the bang for the buck from the risk reduction. So if risk is reduced, people seem to have the money. And it's not that they've been sitting on it. You know, the money has been there largely set aside to as a form of insurance. And if they feel like they have an alternative for insurance, they can reallocate that portfolio. So I've worked for years on capital constraints, and I firmly believe that it's a huge, huge problem. But I think the risk side of that is also very, very important. And that's what part of what I think we're seeing in Mozambique is that if you get people better financial instruments that help them manage risk, there may be a little more liquidity in the system than that's available for investment purposes once the farmer becomes convinced that they can do that in a prudential manner and not actually threaten the family livelihood security.
Well, I'm sorry we can't get to all questions. I always try and end as close to on time as possible. But I very much would like to express my appreciation to our presenters and to all of you who are repeat customers to the Ag Sector Council seminar series. I see a lot of familiar faces this time around. Mm-hmm. So we appreciate it, and we hope to see you at future seminars. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.